Now I know that when you open Genesis, first of all, some of it is cryptic, some of it is obscure to many. Particularly when you come to a chapter like chapter 49, I can almost see the eyes gloss over, trying to read this and get some sense out of it. And yet, in this chapter, as I was reflecting upon this, there are some amazing reflections of the human soul, the human makeup that we're all a part of. Thousands of years ago, people had very similar issues in their lives in regard to choices they made as we do today. It's amazingly contemporary. And particularly in this chapter, we saw Jacob becoming Israel. And what's really amazing is that we left off with Jacob having all of Egypt at his fingertips. Now picture, his whole life has been, it seems, getting one over on Esau, getting one over on Laban, trying to get ahead, increase his stock portfolio, really, really just get rich and do well and succeed. And now he discovers his son Joseph is alive. And not just alive, he's second man in charge of all of Egypt. He's got some serious connections now, right? And now he has a chance for a request. Okay, all right, yeah. Joseph, I want the mansion right there overlooking the Nile and the palm trees. And he's picturing all the servant ladies, you know, waving little palm fronds in front of him as he's sipping his little desert margarita or whatever it is. I think that would be Jacob if it was just Jacob. But there's something different about him. What does he request? We noted, don't bury me here in Egypt. This is where my heart is. He says, of all the things he could ask Joseph, he says, bury me in Canaan. Then he blesses the two sons of Joseph and prophesies over them, Ephraim and Manasseh. And now in chapter 49, we come to his blessing. Verse 1, it says, Jacob called his sons and said, gather together that I may tell you what may befall you or what shall befall you in the last days. Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father. So now he's gathering all of his sons. All 12 of them are gathered around his bed. Interesting. He's going to not just bless them, he's going to prophesy over them. There's predictive nature of these things. He's going to tell them what shall befall them. Now when I read this, I think, well, is this a little bit deterministic? Does this mean that this is something that he's saying? These are prophecies, so essentially there's nothing you can do about them. These predictions are going to happen. Can't change them. Men can't change these, can they? This is God. Yet oddly, what we're going to discover in the natural human makeup of these men, which was in many ways weak, God even chooses those that are weak and uses them in a mighty way. And those predictions that come upon some of them for evil, they turn around and can turn into good when they make the right choices. And these are also particularly, these are remarkable revelations of the human soul that we can glean some helpful truths for our lives. Listen, Jacob is blessing them, but really he's prophesying, and what's even more amazing, it's poetical to boot. This is Hebrew poetry at its best. And by the way, when you read Hebrew poetry translated in English, it loses some. You have to kind of explain a little more, just like any poem translated is kind of odd sounding in another language. Yet there's a richness here. Hebrew poetry never rhymed sounds like we rhyme sounds in our poetry. Hebrew poetry rhymes thoughts. So they'll say one thing and then they'll repeat the thought in another way. And it just accentuates the point being made. Let's take a look at this. What's even more significant is these predictions in chapter 49. You can actually compare with Moses' pronouncements upon the tribes 450 years later, and they're eerily similar and amazingly insightful into human nature. For my part, to make this a little more palatable for us, I kind of grouped them as we'll look at them individually, but I see them as groups. I look at the first group, the first three sons of Jacob is in one group, and I would call that the group of those who had a lack of self-control. We see this in Reuben and in Simeon and in Levi, and the consequences in their lives as a result. And as I think about that, it's one of those areas, wow, is this contemporary? This is the challenge that every man and woman faces. in their lives today, because there's so many options, so many choices. What will you do? You can choose this, you can choose that. To exercise self-control is a very fruitful thing in the end. To deny yourself now what you feel you want in deference for that which is right, you'll find in the end it brings forth a whole lot more fruit. But let's look at what happens when you give in to those desires. Reuben, verse 3, "You're my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, the excellency of power." I mean, come on, this is like whatever father wouldn't say, "My firstborn son, yeah, boy, he's my boy. This is the one, man." You're putting, the firstborn are like that. I mean, you put all the expectations upon them. Everything that you weren't, you want to have your son do and be. You're pouring into them. You know, I didn't quite make the state meet, but you're going to be there. You're going to be representing me, son. And so many fathers live vicariously through their children to the point where let the kid have a break already. But this is the idea, excellency of everything. It's yours to lose, Reuben. Well, unfortunately, he does lose it. Verse 4, it says, he says, "Unstable as water, you shall not excel." I can't picture what he must have looked like around his father's bed as he's hearing this pronouncement. But I think he knows deep down inside it's well earned because of the way he was. He goes on to say, "Because you went up to your father's bed and you defiled it." And then the Hebrew poetry, rhyming the thought, "He went up to my couch." Reuben. Genesis chapter 35, verse 22 says that Reuben went and laid with Bilhah, his father's concubine. His father heard about it. We don't see his father doing anything about it then, but just observing. Somehow or another, you know, now it comes back, the sin comes back to bring forth its fruit. See, sin has lasting consequences. The interesting thing about Reuben, he couldn't control his lusts. And now, he is pronounced that you're not going to excel. When you follow Reuben's line, there is no judge, no prophet, no leader from this tribe. Every spiritual advantage, his to lose, but he loses it. He fails. And when his family tree develops, there's some bad fruit. In fact, in many ways, in Numbers, you look at the number of the people of Reuben at the beginning of Numbers, the number at the end, and they lost ground, not gained ground. Where every other tribe gained ground, Reuben went and decreased. Not only that, there were no leaders among Reuben. In fact, in 1 Chronicles chapter 26, verse 32, is a very odd statement. It says that David had all of the administrators of Hebron administrate over the children of Reuben. They couldn't even come up with their own leaders. I picture Reuben like a tribe of spiritual adolescents. They all want what they want when they want it, and no one wants to do what's right, and they need someone to lead them. What a sad indictment. Reuben also made a foolish choice to stay on the other side of the Jordan with Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh. And as a result, they were the first to be overcome by their enemies. In fact, archaeological proof in history, the Moabite stone in 1868 was discovered. It tells of the victories of the country of Moab over the tribe of Reuben, 9th century B.C. 100 years before the rest of the northern tribes were taken by the Assyrians. What do we learn from this? Well, listen, you can be strong, you can be talented, you can show a lot of potential, but you can utterly fail if you don't control yourself. You know what I'm talking about, guys. Temptations are out there all around you. The click of a mouse. Every pleasure, every possible sexual thing in the world is right at your fingertips. And you think it's all private, you think it's all safe, nobody knows. God knows. I can tell you this, probably there's a whole lot more people know, keeping a catalog of everything you're doing, that'll use it against you one day. But listen, patience, self-control, how important are those attributes, really fruits of the Spirit? Because Reuben loses it all in the end. What a sad picture. I'll tell you, for us today in this generation, there are a lot of Reubens. They're never going to excel. They're never going to amount to anything because they keep giving themselves over to wanting what they want now. I feel I want this and I want it now, and they don't have any self-control. You know, the comparison also between Simeon and Levi is also they lack self-control. Their self-control was in a different area, or their lack of thereof was in a different area. Where Reuben was lust, Simeon and Levi, they lacked control over their anger. They couldn't control their emotions in that realm. Verse 5 says, Simeon and Levi are brothers. Now, it's interesting and very telling that he lists them together. That comes to bear as of great instruction here. He says, instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place. They're actually planning for it. They're ready to be cruel. They're stocking weapons. They're thinking of how they can get ahead to hurt someone else. He says, let not my soul enter their counsel. This is their own father. I don't even want to enter their counsel. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. I don't even be associated with them. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Interesting. They're joined together, inciting each other to do evil. And Jacob says, I'm going to separate you boys. You know, I look at these, let's call them the lost boys, partners in crime. Violent tendencies. And if you recall the story in Genesis 34, when their sister, Dinah, was raped by Hamor, the son of Shechem, they could only think of one thing: revenge. Now, let's put ourselves there. How would you feel? Some knucklehead raping your sister, right? Okay, so we're human. We would feel those things, right? What do you do as a result of being wronged? I want to tell you, first of all, beware of those around you, your friends, those people that are around you that would stir you up to do evil. You know, we all have those types of people in our lives. You know, maybe you're having a struggle with your marriage and you have your friends saying, throw the bum out, get rid of him. Do you need that kind of a friend? Let me ask you, do you need that kind of a friend? Oh, they're telling you what you want to hear. And that's one of the problems. Here is Levi and Simeon, who are way too much alike. And they're not checking each other. They're like a mob stirring each other up to do worse and worse and worse. I can just picture them when Dinah was raped. You know, their brothers are horrified, they're shocked, they're like hurt. And Levi says to Simeon, we're going to get that sucker. We're going to get him. And they're talking back and forth and they're stirring each other up. And the more they stir each other up, the more angry they get, the more angry they start really, they're collecting their weapons. They're getting the plot going and they go out and they kill the entire nation of the Shechemites. Cruelty and revenge. Jacob distances himself. You know, and I think it's wise to distance yourself from people who are angry. In fact, Proverbs tell us in chapter 22, verse 24, Proverbs says, make no friendship with an angry man. You know what I'm talking about. There are people in your life that just are angry. Stay away from them. People like that need to be alone so they can't stir others up until they learn their lesson. An angry man stirs up strife, Proverbs 29, verse 22 says. But the discretion of a man makes him slow to anger, Proverbs 19, 11. What happens to Simeon? In the end, the Bible tells us, when you read his land allotment, you discover something interesting. It's inside the tribe of Judas. So he doesn't even really get his. And then part of the tribe goes to the east. Others go under other authority. They are, just as Jacob predicts, they're scattered. Let me ask you this on a personal level. You cannot escape someone hurting you in this life. You can't do it. It's going to happen. And it might come from even those you thought were your best friends. It might come from your spouse. You know, those who you know the most can hurt you the most. It might come from an employer. And you might have been wronged. You might have been, they did a number on you, totally unjust. You have no recourse, and what do you do with that? I'll tell you what a lot of us struggle with. We struggle with that vengeance in our heart. It stirs up our soul. Every time we think about it, our adrenaline starts pumping. We start getting angry. The veins in our neck are popping out. You don't need to be around somebody that's going to even stir you up more. I can't believe they did that. You're going to let them do that to you? I'll tell you, if I were me, I'd go down there right now and I'd give them a piece of my mind. You know, you get people like that that stir you up. Listen, here's the thing. Simeon didn't deal with it, and now he's scattered. How do you respond? Do you know that most evil acts are done as a response to other evil acts? It all comes down to that. Most evil acts are done to get back at someone that has done something to you. Not only in a marriage, but in friendships, at the job. Think about it. What's caused the greatest evil has been a reaction to other evil. You can't stop the initial sin. It happens. Sin happens. In a marriage, you're going to say the wrong thing to your spouse. You're going to hurt them. It's going to happen. How you respond is the key. And you know that right now in the Muslim world, many people don't realize this, but the whole Muslim foundation is built on revenge. That's why if it were not for the fact that they have the great Satan, the United States, and the little Satan, Israel, to focus their attention on, they'd all be fighting each other because they've done for centuries. You know, he did this to me, and I'm going to get him back even more. I'm going to get him back, and it's revenge, back and forth, back and forth. Do you know that why, right now, Christianity is growing by leaps and bounds in many of these closed nations? Why it's a powerful change in the heart of many Muslims, and they're becoming Christians, right now in the world, is largely because of this trait of Christians of forgiveness. It breaks the chain. And it's startling to those that are used to revenge. They see these relatives of the Christians that they've killed come out publicly, and instead of pronouncing damnation and judgment and vengeance on them and we're going to get you back, saying we forgive you. They can't process that. That's not human. And it's something that's supernatural, the Lord working in the heart to give forgiveness. This, you remember Frank Drown? How many of you saw Frank Drown when he's here on Wednesday night? I don't know when we'll get him back. He's 86 years old. He probably will never be back here. He and his wife sharing of their journeys in Ecuador and among people that were headhunters. But he knew Nate Saint, who was his pilot, who was the one guy killed by the Aka Indians. You couldn't approach the Aka Indians. They would kill you. They'd spear you before you even got close. You go through the jungle and you might see two or three of them and think, okay, you're all right. You wouldn't know there's hundreds of them around you. They were, the government wanted to send soldiers in and exterminate the whole group, people group, because they were just so vicious and cruel. These missionaries found a way to make friends with them, you know, through giving them gifts, you know, by air and an exchange of gifts. It was a wild plan, and it worked. And finally, they decided to make personal contact. They landed a plane, and at first it seemed to go well, but something stirred up in these people. And before you know it, bang, 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 they're all dead. They speared them all. What do you do now? What a loss. What a waste. Remember the whole world, if you were back in that era? I mean, it was in the front of the magazines. I mean, just tragic loss. The wives of those men who were killed decided that it was worth going in and reaching these people who had killed their own husbands. And they went in, and of course, the fierce tribe didn't see a threat with women. If they'd have known that before, they could have sent all the women missionaries first and it would have been safe. You know, they could have reached these people, but they didn't know that. But they wouldn't attack women. And they see these women coming out with their children, and they don't know what to do. And then they discover these are the wives of the people they killed. They thought they'd come for revenge, but no, they saw love and forgiveness, and it got their hearts. See, it's powerful. Levi and Simeon, that's the natural human reaction to someone that does you wrong. Get them back and get them back good. But you see, what breaks that is forgiveness. Now, Simeon, scattered. Now, he also says that Levi will be scattered as well, but you know, there's something interesting that happens with Levi. Levi eventually, something happens. You see, he's got a lot of passion. He's got a lot of heart. He's passionate. And it stirs him up to anger. And you know, that doesn't change. But God actually alters that in a good way. If you're a passionate person, if you're prone to really reacting, and you take initiative, you take action, that's a good trait if it's controlled. And somewhere along the line with the tribe of Levi, when Moses was leading them in the wilderness and it was real iffy, Korah was leading a rebellion, people were confused, which way do we go? Moses said, whoever's with me, come. And the tribe of Levi joined him, stood in there. And one of the tribesmen of Levi Phinehas was a leader. He was passionate. But his zeal, his anger was directed towards sin. And his zeal was for the Lord. And so God, amazingly, in Deuteronomy 33, Moses records this. He says that they were then given because they honored the Lord more than their mother and their father and their brothers. The Lord is going to honor them. And though they were still scattered, you see, Moses' prophecy does not override Jacob's prediction. They're still scattered. They don't get an inheritance, but they become the priestly tribe. They're now called by Moses to give the word of God to the people. And he scatters them in cities, and they become the priestly tribe. See, so God can take that which is bad and turn it into good. You don't have to be a victim of your natural human tendencies. They can be turned for good, and this is what we see in Levi. As it turns out, the greatest prophet, that Jesus said, the greatest prophet that ever lived, came from the tribe of Levi. You know who that was? John the Baptist, the forerunner of our Messiah. Then we come to the second category, who really, there's just one guy here, but he has his own category. Judah. His name means praise. And I believe this category is yieldedness. He's the result of repentance and yieldedness to the Lord. Verse 8, by the way, I say that because of this. Judah is the fourth son. He's just listened to the pronouncements on Reuben and Simeon and Levi, and he's thinking, oh boy, I'm no Boy Scout. These guys got it. That's tough, man. And I, you know what? I'm sure he must have cringed. He was thinking to himself, you know, I encouraged my brothers to sell Joseph. It was me, and I didn't keep my word to my daughter-in-law. I lied. I didn't do what was right. And then I was sleeping with that prostitute who happened to be my daughter-in-law in disguise. And oh, I am so gone. But you know what's amazing? Judah, he says, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. Huh? How'd that happen? You know, there was something that changed in Judah, that he was the one that stepped up and gave his life in trade for Benjamin. He says, take me, I'll be the slave, let Benjamin go. He played the man. He denied himself. And you know what? He yielded himself to the Lord, and I really believe that's why he was so honored. In fact, honored to the degree where his brothers will praise him. And your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Now, Judah is the tribe through whom all the kings of Judah come. David, Saul, the first king, he was man's choice. He was from the tribe of Benjamin and a disappointment. God chose David, a man after his own heart. Then Solomon, and then all the kings. There were a number of bad kings in Judah too, but there were a lot of good kings. But that's where the leadership came. He says, Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you've gone up. He bows down, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who shall rouse him? Now, the language here is interesting because we discover in Revelation there is a description of a descendant of the tribe of Judah. He's called the Lion of the tribe of Judah. None other than Jesus, the Messiah. In fact, mostly, this prophecy is fulfilled not in the weak links of the human connection between the lineage of Judah, but this is fulfilled in that one notable descendant of Judah, Jesus. He's the one who the brothers will praise because he is worthy of praise. He will have his hand on the neck of his enemies. He will overcome in the end. Those will bow down to him. Every knee will bow. Every tongue will confess he is Lord. He is the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And it says in verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. Now the challenge for commentators is to discern what this one word, Shiloh, which is only found here, means. And they've been divided on this because it is a challenging prescription. Shiloh means sent one, one of the roots. The other root means son. Another root means peace. And so you've got these, is it son, is it sent, is it peace? Actually, if you think about it, you're describing the ministry of Jesus in all of them. Particularly in the one that means he is the one to whom he's the rightful heir. So Jacob predicts that Judah will not lose its leadership, its rule, until the Messiah comes. That's what the rabbis understood. And that's why in the first century, this is what happened. There was a certain point in which Rome had had enough of the rebellion of Israel. And they pretty much took away their right to capital punishment. Now, you could have a nation that still had its own sovereignty while it's still a vassal nation to another nation. Many nations were like that. But once that nation was constricted, the right to capital punishment was removed. That is, now they don't have the right to carry out their own laws. Now they've lost their leadership. When that happened, the record shows that the rabbis marched in the streets mourning, crying, throwing dust on their head. Why? Because they thought that the word of God had been broken. Unheard of. Unthinkable. But it's true. We lost our right to rule. And Shiloh has not come. But they didn't know. And a little village up in Galilee, Nazareth, little town, little insignificant town, was a young boy growing up who had been born in Bethlehem, and now he was in Nazareth growing up. The Messiah had come. They just didn't know. Shiloh had come. The word of God was not broken. And then, of course, it talks about his prosperity in verse 11 and 12. Binding his donkey to the vine, his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. See other poetry, the repeating thought. His eyes are darker than wine, his teeth whiter than milk. This is, of course, his prosperity, and it really is depicted in the one prophecy about Jesus, where the Father says to the Son, "Ask of me, and I'll give the nations as an inheritance to you." The object of praise, Shiloh, Judah. It tells us here, and I want you to really think about this. I don't care what baggage you've come with. I don't care what your past is. I don't care whether you ladies maybe had an abortion. I don't care whether, you know, you've been a murderer, you've been a thief, you've been a liar. I don't care whether you've had a homosexual background or you're an adulterer or whatever it is. Paul writes to the Corinthians and says, "Such were some of you." Such were some of you. And Judah, he came with some baggage, but he's a changed man. And now he's the leader of the tribes. Now God is raising him up. And you know, God can take the baggage that you've had in the past, and not only will he forgive you of that, but even the tendencies of weaknesses, the Lord can now turn into something amazing and something good. That's what I see in Judah. And the key is yieldedness. How yielded are you? Listen, if you're still fighting your own battles, if you're still striving with your Maker, if you're still deciding your own path, you're not broken yet. And you're not going to be very helpful to yourself or to others until you learn this lesson. You're still going to be like Simeon and Levi and Reuben. You can't control yourself. And as a result, you won't excel. And you will be scattered. But Judah, he shows us how to overcome. And as a result, he's given the distinct privilege of, through his lineage, the Messiah will come. Now, the next group, I'd have to put Zebulun and Issachar in the same category as those guys let's read it first and then we'll comment on it. I like to just do that. It's a better way to do it. I don't want to put the preconceived idea in your mind. Zebulun shall dwell by the haven of the sea. He shall become a haven for ships, and his border shall adjoin Sidon. Now, right here, this is so cryptic, we have no clue what that means for the most of us. And it says, Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between two burdens. He saw that rest was good and the land was pleasant. He bowed his shoulder to bear a burden and became a band of slaves. All right, here's the thing. A lot of times people like to take the Bible and they don't understand it. And of course they criticize it without understanding it. And certainly when it comes to these descendants, you know, you might already notice that Zebulun and Issachar are actually not the fifth and sixth son, but they're the ninth and the tenth son of Jacob. Why are they listed right here in the fifth and the sixth order? It's because Jacob had four wives. as they're around the bed, he's kind of going from one to the other, and he's addressing them in groups. These are the sons of Leah. Then these are the sons of the concubines, and then these are the sons of Rachel. And he addresses them separately and in those categories. So now Zebulun and Issachar, the last two sons of Leah, he addresses and says things that are kind of cryptic. And what do we get out of this? Well, Deuteronomy goes on to say that Issachar will partake of the abundance of the seas and the treasures in the sand. So make that connection. You realize that at first you might think they're on the shore, right? They're a haven of ships. No, they're actually not. When you look at the geography, by the way, this brings up a very important point. You open the Bible. Listen, there are many things right on the surface. I open my Bible and I go, wow, I can just, man, that verse speaks to my heart right now. There are other passages that you go, huh? What in the world is he talking about? I don't get it, and we just want to move on. I'll go to something I can understand. That happens all the time. And you know what? When you're just starting, it's not a bad idea because you're not going to be able to tackle all these themes at once. But listen, when you start growing in the Lord, you've got to understand there's some buried treasure. And you know what? He doesn't put everything on the surface. He does for the babes. It's wonderful. You could be a brand new Christian and open the Bible and get some meat, just some milk, just refreshment, encouragement. But as you grow, you need to be challenged to dig deeper. Like, you know, open up your concordance or see a map. You know, where is the tribes here? Some of your maps in the Bible, and if you don't have a good study Bible that has the maps, I'd suggest getting one. And you can actually go, oh, okay, wow, you can see how the tribes are there and they're laid out. And you can see how, oh, well, wait a minute. It says he's by the sea, but he's not by the sea. I don't get it. Till you read Deuteronomy 33, and then you discover that they're going to partake of the abundance of the seas and of the sand. And when you look at where they are, you discover, oh, they're on a main trade route between Sidon and the coast. So Issachar, or Zebulun, and then later Issachar, close by, had the same natural advantage. They were raking in the money. Trade, booming. Everyone who go through their territory, they, of course, tax them and they'd trade with them, and they became very wealthy. They were blessed. Zebulun, Deuteronomy tells us he had the abundance of it. And of course, we also see Issachar had the abundance. But what did they do with this abundance? Which provides a very important question for our souls. What do you do when your soul is made fat? When you got more than you need? When you've been blessed prosperity, you've been blessed with a natural talent perhaps, you've been able to be very successful. Hey Zeb, Issachar, what are you doing with that? Well, you know, it's interesting to me that being in this very strategic and prosperous position, very well situated, and you might be well situated with work and income and property, what do you do with it? That's the key. Are you being a blessing to the next generation? Are you thinking of more than just yourself? Are you thinking of how you can be a channel to be a blessing? Here's where Zebulun and Issachar made their mistake. Now, we're not really told too much about Zebulun. We are told Issachar, hey, he was a strong donkey. That's actually not a bad thing. Call somebody a strong donkey, now not so pleasant. But then, that was actually you're a hard-working guy. But eventually, you know, became so prosperous, he lied down, saw that rest was good. Hey, I've made so much money from my hard work, I'm going to chill out for a while, babe. You know, come on. That's what he does. That's what he does. And so, therefore, eventually he turns into a band of slaves. They become subject. They become less influential. They had influence. What did they do with it? That's what frustrates me. Listen, hear my heart on this. Because it kind of wearies me when I hear people say, oh, he's getting political again. As if I really think that my real change or mission and passion is to change the political climate of the state or nation. I don't care about that. But here's what I do care about. I care about Christians not being backed into a corner, pushed on the reservation, keep your little Christianity in your church, but don't bring it in the public square. And you believe that? Why would we believe that? How can we be influential? if we get our little security and we back off and we don't want to have our influence reach any farther. What frustrates me about our leaders in Trenton and in Washington is this. The way the political climate is, they don't care for more than the next election. They don't care about your children or your children's children. They don't care about... They're mortgaging right now your children's future financially. And they're mortgaging it, they're selling it morally with the decisions that are being made. Take away 5,000 years of human history and tradition in marriage for the sake of appealing to a political correct approach to people that are very... Listen, it all comes down to money, ultimately. It's not about gay marriage. It's about money. I'll tell you how it works. Very simple. We're told, beware the God of mammon. I mean, this is really the problem. You cannot serve mammon and God. And here's what happens. These lobbyists are very powerful. Why? There's a lot of money in the obsessions of men. When you're a gambler, you've got that obsession, you have very little sales resistance. There's a lot of money to be had in the gambling industry. When you're obsessed with sex, a lot of money to be made off you when you're obsessed with sex. You'll spend money like you can't believe to satisfy that. All of these vices that we have, there's a lot of money to be had. And there are powerful lobbyists representing these vices. Of course, you know, when the sex industry goes, then of course now the abortion industry, that's going to clean up the mess after all the sexual stimulation. Clean up the nasty mess, the inconvenience, get rid of all that. And essentially now what you have is a lot of money in all of those industries, powerful lobbyists whispering in the ears of these men and women who only care about the next election. I'm not saying all of them, because there are some really fine people that are serving and laboring and diligently working hard in that field. But for many of them, it's very disappointing. And of course, people hear me talk like this and think I'm going to rah-rah, you know, wave the banner and let's get out there and vote. Listen, I think we need to let our salt and light be influential in every area of the world, whether it's finance, whether it's political, whether it's spiritual, in every area, I believe. Maybe you have influence. What are you doing with that? That's the key. For Zebulun and Issachar, when you follow out the tribes, you discover, particularly in Issachar, he was listed very prosperous, but eventually became complacent. And then eventually he was forced into slavery by the Assyrians. The point is for all of us to never stop growing. Don't become complacent. Someone once asked, what do you think two of the biggest problems in the world are today? And a person says, I don't know and I don't care. And the other person says, wow, you nailed it right there. Apathy and ignorance. I don't know and I don't care. Listen, we need to really take a little more responsibility for the privilege we have. You know, as an American, you have access to a passport, and the powerful nation stands behind that passport. You go into another nation, your nation will fight for you as an individual. That's ridiculous in the world. Nothing ever like this. The other thing about America, you can go live in Germany, you can go live in England. You'll never be a German if you're not born there. You're a transplant. You'll never be an Englishman if you go there. You're a transplant. You'll never be whatever, but you come to this country, you can be an American. No matter what background you have, you are an American with equal rights. You know what? Listen, this is just unheard of. And most of these things came from our founding fathers who were rooted. They grew up with the Bible. They grew up with these concepts and tried to make some sort of a government, though they knew it would be faulty because human nature is faulty. They tried to put the checks and balances in because they knew this. And yet, here you have Issachar and Zebulun basically now, instead of using their natural prosperous ability and position for others, they spend it on themselves and they end up with nothing. Many people in the church, many people in the community, there's a lot of work to be done. Don't stop serving the Lord. Use what you have. So the blessings on the six sons of Leah are finished. Now we come to the next category. I love this category. I love the next four guys. I'll tell you why. These were the sons of the concubines. I mean, Jacob wasn't wise in marrying so many women. It hurt him. There was a lot of family friction. Sometimes people read the Bible and they go, oh, well, the Bible, come on, you Christians talk about marriage between one man and one woman. Well, look at your heroes. Jacob and Abraham and look at David and Solomon. You guys are hypocrites. Listen, I want to tell you something. Nowhere in the Bible does God ever approve of those decisions that these men made. Don't think that just because the Bible records their decisions, that God is approving of that. Jesus made it very plain. From the beginning, it was not so. God caused a man and a woman to be joined together and become one flesh. One man, one woman. That's what God designed. You try to tinker with that one, you'll do so at your own hurt, and society's hurt, and the nation's hurt. But listen, you've got to see the cost. So I look at these guys. Now picture, you're around the bed there, Jacob's dying. You're Gad, you're Naphtali, you're Asher, you're Dan, those four tribes. Dan and Naphtali were from Rachel's maiden, Bilhah, and Gad and Asher were from Leah's maiden, Zilpah. You're kind of like, your status is not that high. Oh, you're the son of the concubine. Okay, yeah, all right. We don't really want to listen to you. We don't really care. You're already a natural disadvantage. This is what I love about these. Do you know the Bible says that God chooses the foolish things of the world to confound the wise? And though these men, some might argue, should have never existed if Jacob hadn't sinned, yet God, you see, the fruit of sin is still a soul. And that child born out of wedlock, that child born as a result of even rape, that child born as a result of sin perhaps, is still a soul valuable in the eyes of God. And you know, God has a purpose. And God can raise that person up. And I love this about Dan. I call this category, out of weakness, became strong. Dan, verse 16, shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a servant by the way, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heel, so its rider shall fall backward. Now, what's wild about this is, okay, you're here, now you're coming to Dan and you're thinking, oh boy, this is not going to be good. If those guys were the sons of the good wife, you know, and oh, this is going to be not so good. All of a sudden, Dan hears, you will judge your people, that was one of the tribes of Israel. Like, what? I imagine the other brothers are like, huh? But he pronounces upon this Dan, this little serpent, by the way. A little serpent, little nothing. He can bite the heel of the horse. In this context, it's actually a good thing that he is little, but he's tough. But there's another spiritual picture here, because Jacob all of a sudden goes off tangent into this saying in verse 18 that does not fit the context. You could take it out and you wouldn't skip a beat. But there's something wild about this, because it's the first mention of the word salvation in the Bible. Always take note of first mention. I have waited for your salvation, O Lord. Now, why did he say that, and why now? Because later on, you're going to discover, well, you do already have an indication, that a serpent is not a good thing. And that the first prophecy of the serpent, he would bite the woman's seed on the heel, but the woman's seed, the Messiah, would crush him on the head. Dan, conspicuously, is missing in the list of the tribes in Revelation. And it's a very good possibility that the Antichrist comes from the tribe of Dan. And Dan, somewhere along the line, goes down that road. But in this context, at least, he's small but mighty. You know, one of the most notable judges of Israel comes from the tribe of Dan. Anybody know who that is? Samson. I heard somebody whisper it. Samson. What's amazing is that God takes the little and he makes him strong. But there is a great picture here prophetically. In the end, the tribe of Judah, through whom the seed of the woman comes, is going to crush the serpent on the head. Then we have Gad. Verse 19 says, Gad, a troop shall tramp upon him. Ouch. But he shall triumph at the last. I call Gad the comeback kid. You know, he's beaten up. I mean, he did make a bad decision. He joins Reuben and half-tribe of Manasseh on the other side of the Jordan. Naturally, he's on the fringes. And naturally, on the fringes, you know, listen, you live on the fringe of Christianity, you're going to get beaten up. You're half in the world, half in the Lord. You're with your worldly friends, you're partying, you're drinking, you're carrying on. And you come to church, you look all pious, and you're not happy. And eventually, you're going to feel this church stuff is irrelevant because your heart is not focused on the things of God. You're on the fringe. and you're going to be a target of the enemy there. You got to make your mind up to come closer, get deeper, grow in the Lord, get focused on the Lord, just get plugged into some smaller groups, get face to face with people, because it's about those relationships, choosing godly people in your lives. That's a choice you've got to make. If you have an inclination to be around people that are clever and witty and godless in a bad way instead of those people in the church, and you look at people in the church with disdain, oh, they're boring, they don't have any fun, they're this and that. Listen, that's a revelation of where your heart is, not where the people of God are. That's where your heart is. You bit the poison apple and you know it's very, very, very tasty, but you don't see where the end of the road is. I think of young people when they first start having sex outside of marriage. It's like you can see it in their eyes. They bit the poison apple. It's all they can think about. But you see, they don't know by starting that fire outside of the fireplace of marriage, it's going to burn their house down. They don't see it. It doesn't make sense to them. They think, ah, you're being too fussy, and all you old people don't get it. You don't understand our generation. People haven't changed in thousands of years. People are still people, and God has the best prescription for the greatest happiness if you trust Him. So I think Gad, you know, he certainly made some bad decisions, and he was exposed to the raids of the Ammonites and the Moabites. He was always getting picked on. But in the end, you know, there's an interesting thing. When David came to gather men around him, the Bible tells us in 1 Chronicles 12 that the Gadites joined David in the wilderness. While David was just in the wilderness running for his life, these Gadites saw something in David. And they joined themselves to David. And it says in here that they were mighty men of valor, men trained for battle, who could handle shield and spear, whose faces were like the faces of lions, swift as gazelles on the mountains. I mean, it's very mountainous in the area of Gad if you go over there. It's just very mountainous. And you climb up and down those mountains all day, you're going to be some strong-legged people. And they were. So Gad, come back, kid. He gets his head together. Then Asher. Asher and Naphtali, let's put them together. Because I see both of them as passing on the blessing and using your talent for God. It's all we know about Asher. It says, bread from Asher shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. In Deuteronomy 33, when Moses gets around to talking about this tribe, he describes him, let his foot dipped in oil, his sandals shall be iron and bronze, and all of his days so strength shall be. In other words, you know what? This is a secret of life. He's rich, but he's yielding. He's got all of these things, but he's passing them on to others. That's the secret of happiness. If God has blessed you, be a channel. Pass it on. You hoard it to your own hurt, like Zebulun and Issachar. But when you're like Asher, you're yielding your royal dainties. You're blessing others with what you have. And Naphtali is a deer let loose. He uses beautiful words. Naphtali, of course, Deuteronomy describes him as just satisfied with flavor. In fact, shall be full of the blessing of the Lord and possess the west and the south. He was full. And, of course, when Jesus first came, he came to the regions of Zebulun and Naphtali, and that's where he began his ministry. Among those who were naturally inclined to be a blessing to others and those who were naturally inclined to be a blessing to themselves, little mixture of people there around Galilee, Jesus came. The lesson here for all of us is this. Listen, if God has blessed you, pass it on. Now we come to Joseph, the fifth category. I call him, and I think of Benjamin in this category as well, overcoming with the Lord. Although Benjamin has a little different track. Joseph, we don't have to talk a lot about because we've really looked at his life. All we need to do is read this and go, oh yeah, remember that. Let's read it. Joseph. Verse 22, is a fruitful bough. A fruitful bough by a well. His branches ran over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him. Now you can relate with that, right? Remember, it's a poetic expression. They shot at him and hated him. His brothers sold him. He was accused of raping Potiphar's wife, thrown into prison falsely. He was bitterly grieved. And in that way, becomes like a type of Jesus as well. But notice verse 24, yet his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hand were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. There's the secret. It wasn't his strength. There was something supernatural happening with Joseph. For there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel, by the God of your father who will help you, by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, and blessings of the breasts and of the womb. The blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors. Up to the utmost bounds of the everlasting hills, they shall be on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of him, of the head of him who was what? Separate from his brethren. That's what made Joseph so unique. Because he knew God. Five titles for God in this one little passage. Five titles of God that Joseph was akin to. The Mighty One of Jacob, the Shepherd, the Stone or Rock of Israel, your Father's God, the Almighty. That was the secret of Joseph. We'll see, we'll talk a little more about him in the closing chapters because his final words are telling and they sum up the purpose of God in the heart of a man. And I believe that we'll be greatly encouraged by how he addresses his brothers in the end. But let's jump to Benjamin. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey. At night he shall divide the spoil. That's all it says about Benjamin. And, the interesting thing about Benny here, last born, youngest in the family. You ever noticed about the last born, the youngest? They've always got to prove themselves, right? See, I was the youngest. I had three older sisters. And I don't know if that put in me a drive to excel because I wanted to prove myself or whatever. I don't know. But I know that youngest oftentimes, they're either the spoiled brat or they're the ones that are always being kicked around and they have to prove themselves. And I know in wrestling families, the youngest brother, when he gets older, look out. Because he's going to whip some people. He's going to prove himself. And there's something about these youngest guys. And Benjamin was tough. In fact, from this little tribe comes a number of judges and kings and leaders. Ehud, one of the judges. Saul, the king. Jonathan, his son, amazing guy. Love Jonathan. Abner, leader, Mordecai, and even Esther from this tribe. Bold, but eventually pretty savage. In fact, they did some wrong things. Gibeah was a city of Benjamin, and there's a whole sordid tale in Judges 21 about things that had happened. And even Saul of Tarsus was from the tribe of Benjamin, who became Paul. So I look at this and I think, you know, here is overcoming with the Lord. That's the key. Whatever you're facing, whatever baggage you've come in with, whatever disadvantages you have compared to others, why are you so focused on them? Because if you're like Joseph, you'll say, hey, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. I know my God is bigger than all of the circumstances I face. I can trust Him in it. And this is the challenge for all of us, to learn how to trust. But you know, as we close here, he goes on to say, the 12 tribes of Israel, this is what their father spoke to them, and he blessed them and blessed each one according to his blessing. And then he charged them, verse 29, and said, I am to be gathered with my people, bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham brought with the field. But, you know, you're reading this, and by the time you get here, you've already, like, lost, right? You're like, I don't care. These fields, where is he talking about? Get a little map out. You know what? I know you would love. I get this request all the time. Oh, it'd be so wonderful if you'd use PowerPoint, Pastor. We could see these things. Yeah, wouldn't you love that? If you can't take the time to open up your Bibles and listen, this is supposed to be the dessert. As we gather, encourage one another in the Lord. But you've got to do some home cooking. You've got to get in the Word yourself. Because you know what? You could come here every week and listen dutifully and it will mean absolutely nothing if you yourself are not digging in. So dig in. But listen, I want to encourage you in that, but listen to this. I know that most of you by this point would not have even finished this phrase. And you might have missed one of the greatest treasures here. Let's move on. In the field of Ephron, the Hittite is a possession for a burial place. Verse 31, there they buried Abraham and Sarah's wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is there were purchased from the sons of Heth. Let's stop there for a minute. Did you notice in that run-on sentence that he throws in there, "There I buried Leah." Did that catch your attention? Did that strike you as odd? Did that catch you? Listen, what did Jacob do? When he met Rachel, he was head over heels in love with the girl. All he could think about, 7 years waiting for her. And he goes on his honeymoon night and, you know, he spends time with her. He's with her all night and wakes up in the morning and it's Leah. The one with the weak eyes. And, you know, frankly, that's a very polite way of saying she wasn't that great looking. She was not endowed with Miss USA features. Well, interesting to me that he wants to be buried with Leah. Does that strike you as interesting? Is it possible? Is it possible that Leah was indeed God's choice? And because he was so enamored with Rachel, he didn't get it. Leah was not the loved one. He marries Rachel. And then, of course, the other ladies come into his life because they want more kids, you know, and their wives are in competition, which is always a problem. And, you know, it's, again, all the problems that come as a result of it. You see, God takes all of our stupidity and sin and still then works his perfect plan, raising the 12 tribes of Israel. But he wants to be married with Leah. This is prophetic to me. This is an acknowledgement, Jacob. The one who had strived with God his whole life is now saying, "God, I get it. You gave me this woman. I want to be buried with her." Guys, if we could only walk by faith and begin to see the inner beauty in women around us that maybe you've already checked off your list because they don't possess that beauty in the outside that makes you go, "Oh, wow." I'll tell you, you'd be wise to check them back on your list and maybe think clearly. Maybe this is the one the Lord has put right in my path and I haven't even recognized it because I haven't seen her in that light. Or seen him in that light. Listen, it goes both ways. I believe by faith. And when Jacob had finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. Jacob dies, no earthly city, no home here. Bury me not in Egypt, not in all this glory of the man and the world. My heart is in heaven. And I believe for us, whatever human traits you have, on this side of eternity, the lesson in these sons of Jacob, the reflections of the souls here, are lessons for us to put first things first, to prioritize in a different way than we have, and to trust in the living God who sent His Son, because it all gives the glory to Jesus through whom our salvation comes. "I have waited for your salvation," Jacob says in that expression right in the middle of these prophecies.